Tantor Audio presents Operation Greylord, the true story of an untrained undercover agent and America's biggest corruption bust, by Terence Hake with Wayne Klatt. Narrated by Charles Constant. Introduction. The judge is condemned when the guilty are acquitted. Scottish proverb. Today, crime victims and their families are fairly assured of seeing justice carried out, but it wasn't always that way in Chicago. The system was so crippled by corruption when I became a young prosecutor that no one knew how to fight it. But then the U.S. Justice Department chose the city for an experiment in reaching the roots of judicial bribery. Although there would be a personal cost for me, I was privileged to have been inside Operation Greylord from the beginning. It used to be thought that lawyers corrupted judges, but we found that judges were pressuring defense attorneys for bribes and even setting their own rates. By freeing criminals, the judges were in effect taking part in their rapes, robberies, and murders. During the undercover investigation, we learned that perhaps half the judges in the nation's largest circuit court system could be bought or made to comply. They were merely scarecrows draped in black robes. Those who refused to sell their ideals had their careers sidelined by being assigned to the lesser courts. Any case could be rigged, from a traffic ticket to a mob hit. There was even a rumor that some innocent people were being convicted just to make crooked jurists appear tough on crime. City Hall and police headquarters were interlocked with the courts by corruption, with each protecting the other. It had always been this way, good people said with a shrug, but, as we learned, it hadn't. For me, the most shocking perversion of justice was the freeing of notorious mob killer Harry Alleman. On the night of September 27, 1972, truck dispatcher William Logan was leaving home for work when Alleman called out from the shadows, "Hey, Billy!" As Logan turned around, he was cut down by 3 shotgun blasts. A neighbor walking his dog saw the short, slender gunman heading for a car, and a woman talking on the phone glimpsed the man's face through a window. She shuddered because he looked so much like Alleman, whom she remembered from her old neighborhood. Law schools never prepare students for reality, and many honest prosecutors were quitting rather than either becoming tainted by the system or losing at every turn. I was just starting out in the state's attorney's office, known in some states as the district attorney's office, when experienced prosecutors practically danced in delight over Alleman's indictment, the first airtight case against a hitman in Murder City's bloody history. We thought it was the start of a new era. All of us were stunned when the judge ignored testimony and set Alleman free to kill again and again as the syndicate's boogeyman. Just the mention of his name made people keep quiet or pay their debts. Outfit leaders grew so arrogant that they shrugged off fairly new federal anti-racketeering laws as if nothing could touch them. And so the Justice Department decided to make Chicago a test case for an experiment, a coordinated counteroffensive using wiretaps and moles in several capacities. No single person was involved in every aspect of what became the longest and most successful undercover operation in FBI history. I was involved in the criminal courts aspect. It began in 1980 when I was a 28-year-old prosecutor, just 3 years out of law school. I complained to my mentor in the state's attorney's office about the case-fixing in the murder, rape, and child molestation court in Chicago. I was ready to quit in disgust, because these were the most serious cases in our criminal justice system. My mentor decided to forward my complaint to the state's attorney and his special prosecutions unit, coincidentally, as the federal government was planning its experimental investigation. When the Justice Department decided to take the state's attorney into its plans, my name came up as a person the FBI might want to talk with. No one knew at the time how massive Operation Greylord would become, leading to an overhaul of the entire system, as well as 3 suicides and more than 70 indictments. I spent 3 years passing myself off first as a crooked prosecutor and then as a fixer, a defense lawyer with connections to certain judges. But when I served as a defense attorney, all my clients were undercover FBI agents who had faked minor crimes so that they might appear before targeted judges. I think only someone as hopelessly naive and optimistic as I had been would have volunteered to put himself in such danger and, in effect, give up his law career. I found myself a sheep wandering in a wilderness of wolves. This is the first inside account of the takedown that involved several unprecedented steps, beginning with bugging a judge's chambers to pick up conversations about bribes. Then, for the first time in America, a judge was convicted of taking bribes in murder cases. And finally, Alleman was tried a second time for the same killing. In the furthest-reaching decision arising from Greylord, the Illinois Supreme Court ruled that double jeopardy protection does not apply when the outcome of the first trial is predetermined, and the U.S. Supreme Court did not take the appeal. It took 20 years, but justice finally won out. Alleman was sent to prison, and the mob was no longer invincible. You are about to see what it was like to move among sleazy and dapper fixers in courts, restaurants, and even the racetrack, and to talk in bribery code to judges and bagmen. The burden of playing this game without rules came close to wearing me down. When I testified in one of the trials, a top defense lawyer tried to break me on the stand by attacking my most vulnerable point, my guilt over making friends among the shysters so that I might betray them. That is the agonizing necessity for anyone working undercover. I recovered on the stand, and judges banned any mention of Greylord to avoid giving prosecutors an edge in the corruption trials. I was honored to be part of the investigation, even though my life has never been the same. Our investigation was conducted simultaneously with the Justice Department's assault on the Chicago mob hierarchy, based on the information from a gambler who had been shot and left for dead. The evidence showed how the crime syndicate paid off Chicago politicians with money skimmed from Las Vegas casinos, using Kansas City mobsters as middlemen. I was not part of the crime syndicate probe, but watched with pleasure as the two crackdowns, occasionally involving the same people, exposed and crushed the old line mob. The two-pronged assault on what had seemed an impregnable fortress helped establish a framework for investigating corruption anywhere in America. But as long as there is a feeling that lawyers should never gather evidence against their colleagues, there will be a need for investigations like Operation Greylord. All conversations in this book are drawn from my memory, testimony, secret tape recordings, court transcripts, and FBI reports. Events involving crooked lawyers and judges have been reconstructed from thousands of pages of transcripts from the major trials. Part 1. Entry Level. 1. A Game Without Rules. June 1980. There had to be a way of infiltrating the systemized corruption in Chicago courts, of sneaking through the wall that had protected shysters and judges for more than half a century. In the early 1970s, three people in the New York City District Attorney's Office were convicted of taking $15,000 to quash a weapons charge against an undercover agent posing as a street criminal. But the evidence had been gathered by having agents commit perjury before a grand jury and judges. A shocked appeals court sided with the defense and held that the investigators had allowed their contempt for bribers to spill over into disdain for all participants in the system. The Justice Department realized that any future investigation of corruption in the United States would have to work within the integrity of the system as a whole, and that meant never tape recording in courtrooms and grand jury chambers. It absolutely needed a mole, like me. But I had gotten nowhere despite weeks of trial and error. The Justice Department had shown me a list of people almost certainly on the take, and narcotics court judge Wayne Olson was one of the most notorious for taking bribes in drug arrests. Although murder is worse than drug peddling, most killers don't have the connections and money that cocaine dealers have. Bug-eyed Olson had been canny enough to protect himself from investigations for years, yet I had to get evidence against him if I was to reach any more important judges. Knowing Olson's volatility, in a fit of temper he had once accidentally killed a man, the chief judge of the criminal courts kept him in the lowly job of deciding whether evidence in hundreds of drug arrests was strong enough for trial. This allowed Olson to arrange regular payoffs from defense attorneys, who sometimes even stood in line to pay.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?